This is Radio 3. In about half an hour, we are broadcasting a special programme recorded by French Radio in the Royal Festival Hall last September. It is a performance of Arbuckle's Fourth Symphony, The Humorous, with the orchestra of the English National Opera under their conductor, Charles Maracas. Maracas. This programme was first broadcast on Radio 1 last June, in the series These You Have Never Knowingly Understood. That's in about 25 minutes. But first, our weekly look at personalities behind the headlines.
Hello. Today we're going to talk to Richard. So instead, we're going to examine the life and times of one of the greatest living Britons, Sir Benjamin Fletcher. Writer, statesman, soldier and academic, cabinet minister, philosopher, Nobel Prize winner, Christian, scholar, broadcaster, musician, mountaineer, vice-chancellor of Salford University, painter, farmer, merchant banker, angler, diplomat, oceanographer, historian, magistrate, horseman, collector, wit, raconteur, roué, animal lover, and television personality. A great man indeed. A man who achieved so much with just the application of his great gift of common sense. That's the sort of sense, he used to say, that even common people have. Our story begins at Kilburn Castle in Berkshire, one dull grey afternoon in late November 1918. It had been drizzling for most of the day. The sky was overcast, and rainwater was scudding off the sheep's backs like mulled wine off a baby's bottom. The Marquis of Kilburn, Sir Benjamin's father, was visiting the Marchioness for the first time after the birth of their first child.
The Marquis, milady!
Harry.
My dear, how is the little blighter?
Fine, fine.
Well, is it a boy or a girl?
It's a girl.
Oh. Still, it was a jolly good effort, my dear.
Oh, thank you, Harry.
The Kilburns had to wait another year for the birth of the son and heir that the Marquis so sorely desired. In the words of J.R.F. Milton, without son, without heir, how the earth would be bare. The whole village was brought to its feet again.
Come on, you crads, up you get. There's another one on the way.
The Marchioness is greatly indebted to you for this spontaneous show of affection, and is greatly pleased to announce the birth of a boy!
It's a boy. That's a boy.
It's a boy.
It's a boy.
Just another neck for the noose, or body for the rack.
Oh, do shut up, Roger. It's a boy. It's a boy. It's a boy.
And so to a childhood of great luxury and an education of privilege. Few things were denied the young Benjamin, least of all real estate. To him, his father gradually apportioned responsibility for the running of all his estates. He was given his first farm at birth and numerous items of agricultural machinery the following Christmas. Wealth thus amassed resulted in him having, at the age of 5 and a half, personal control over nearly 65,000 acres of East Anglia, as well as a turnip plantation near Whitehaven and a rat-catching agency on the Norfolk Broads. Sir Benjamin's formal education began at the age of 8 at a prep school near Ascot. Someone who knew him very well at this time was Matthew Fraser, his metalwork teacher, who is now provost of Glasgow City. And it was in Glasgow that he spoke with Michael Brinkman.
He was a great guy. A great man. A great friend. At school, he was very popular. Very popular, and it was terrific, actually, whenever he got any duck. You know, any food from home, because he'd always measure the background for what you're going to do after the fact we've got to get to your duck, wasn't he? Right? I remember that happened all the time. And he was a great joke teller, of course, a great storyteller. There's a great tale he used to tell, I remember, about him and a friend of his from home. Who apparently, the two of them used to take the back room together and scrap like a boat like a dog. You know, Plop, how many times did Dr. Plop that damn down about the other way around the tree? But that didn't last long. I knew that one day, despite everything, he'd settle down. And he certainly did.
Right. How was he academically?
Oh, intelligent, but never did a stroke of luck. Not a stroke. It was always a secondary consideration with him, you know. If only he'd done a kind of thing, I'd get back. Right.
But he never did.
No, he never did.
Mr. Fraser, you've been no end of help.
Oh, it's all right. It's all right. By the way, your tape recorder is still running if you want that to stop.
If I were to speak epigrammatically, one might say that from the horrors of prep school, Sir Benjamin went on to become the horror of public school. But this would not be fair. Beaten boys knew that they had done wrong. When Sir Benjamin arrived, he dedicated himself to two aims. The achievement of power and popularity on the one hand, and of the Ridgeway Cup for acting on the other. His acting career started in the part of Cleopatra, as the careers of so many great actresses have ended.
I leave you, lady.
Courteous lord, one word. Sir, you and I must part, but that's not it. Sir, you and I have loved, but there's not it. That you know well.
It was a performance of startling intensity, which showed infinite promise. Mr. Pankhurst, head of drama.
Fletcher's Cleopatra. Perfection. Performance of startling intensity. Oh, infinite promise.
The next year, his voice was breaking.
Always a difficult time.
And his heart was breaking, too, when he was offered the part of Curio in Twelfth Night, a short 8-word cameo role.
Will you go hunt, my lord?
What Curio?
The heart.
No, it wasn't a big part, but there was a lot a great actor could squeeze out of it.
Sir Benjamin wasn't convinced, and wrote a letter to the Times. He was recast as Hamlet in the play of the same name. His performance was brilliant.
A little more than kin and less than kind.
But unsatisfied, he demanded the play be repeated the next year. By this time, the voice had broken beyond belief.
But now my cousin Hamlet and my son.
A little more than kin and less than kind.
It was a sensation, and undoubtedly the deepest performance by any actor in the history of the school. The response was amazing, and soliloquy after soliloquy was called back for encore, scene after scene repeated. Young boys swooned, and senior masters passed away. The Ridgeway Cup was recast in gold, and the headmaster's daughter offered herself in marriage. Sir Benjamin refused, as he recently recollected in tranquillity.
Well, I didn't want to marry the first piece of tat that came to hand.
The performance was repeated annually, but concentrating on other matters, Sir Benjamin found he had less and less time for acting, and after receiving the Adolf Prize for Discipline, he almost gave it up entirely, apart from the recital of crucial soliloquies at time of national crisis. At last the day came to leave the Alma Mater. The old school sang the old song with tears in their eyes.
Like a nation's mountain growing from a molehill to the sky, so we follow, coming, going, to rule this land eternally.
The farewells were said.
Goodbye, Fresher.
Goodbye, Headmaster.
Look after yourself.
Will do, HM.
And the future lay before him, a turkey just waiting to be stuffed.
Bye-bye, Fletcher.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Fletcher.
Bye-bye.
Good luck.
Bye-bye. I love you deeply, you know that.
Good tree, Smelly.
One of Sir Benjamin's closest friends at public school was Doggy Toboggan. Later, Dr. Ronald Toboggan, Archbishop of York, and more recently, of Canterbury. He spoke, at Lambeth, to Gerald Bell.
Yes. Oh, Benjamin was so funny in those days, a real wag. I remember, in the dormitory at night, he used to... he used to climb onto his bed... He used to take his... He used to... spin it round the... Oh!
Let me help you, Archbishop.
Oh, that's very kind.
When at school, did Sir Benjamin ever show any great interest in politics or current affairs?
Yes. Yes, I seem to remember the Sixth Form Debating Society was one of his little rainchilds. That was great fun. I remember we once had a joint balloon debate with the local girls' school, and right in the middle of the first round of voting, Benji, he suddenly leapt up, and he grabbed this... this poor lady cadaver woman round there, and he started...
Sir Benjamin left school for university at the age of 19. He worked hard, beagling being his only extracurricular activity, and he took a formal first from Balliol College, Oxford, in 1940. He went from here into a long and successful career in journalism that spanned 20 years before he entered politics seriously in the early 60s. The 50s were a particularly fruitful time. From 1955 until 1958, Sir Benjamin was an agony columnist with the New Statesman. The editor at the time was David Wynne Davis Davis. Michael Brinkman spoke to him on the phone.
Oh, he was great. He was knockout. Knockout. He just had a way with the words. That was the top and the...
bottom.
A bottom of it, yeah. He just had a way with the words.
What kind of words?
Oh, you know, look in the dictionary, really. He used a lot of them ones. He'd just string a few together in his head, hammer them into some semblance of order and fling them down onto the paper. Then onto the next sentence.
An exhaustive procedure.
Yeah, but... but that's what writing's all about.
Well, you're right, of course.
Yeah.
Was his writing of a high quality?
Well, he was a fountain pen man, of course. I could never take the leaking myself, but he was a devotee. Because he couldn't type. I don't know why. He used to get his fingers stuck between the keys. But yeah, he could write. Real neat. Look, if you don't shut your gob, I'll sew it up. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's all right. Many have described his style of journalism as being that of a latter-day George Orwell.
Who?
George Orwell. Eric Blair.
No, I don't think they influenced him that much. He was essentially very original. Kept himself very much to himself.
Meaning?
I'm not sure, actually.
But he was a great contributor.
Oh, huge. Yeah. Huge.
Sir Benjamin has frequently been at the centre of controversy. In a discussion with the then-young George Davis on a panorama programme in 1965, women's liberation was one of the topics considered.
And the nakedness of woman is the work of God.
But I think women should have these rights too. I mean, it's silly to sit there and say it's a man's world.
Look, God made the woman for the man.
Oh, rubbish. Absolute rubbish.
Well, that's what they say.
Tommy rot. Women should be liberated.
Chain-wise,
yeah. And, I mean, never more so than in a marriage. I mean, that old truism about marriage, you know, starting when you sink into his arms and finishing with your arms in the sink, I mean, wasn't just taken off a tea towel.
Well, you're right, but of course it actually derives from the PMS dilemma.
PMS?
Premarital sex.
Of course.
I mean, people say, don't they, that it is so essential to establish the physical relationship before entering any long-term emotional one. Mm. But I ask, is it?
I think the crucial word here is long-term.
Well, it's two words.
Both quite short.
That's quite short, that's right. Because it's not a long-term problem.
It's a short-term problem?
Well, it's a problem in the short term, certainly. But having said that, you suddenly realise that so many problems are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sex discrimination, I would probably disagree with on principle. But discrimination against sex is just downright unproductive. And yet, at the same time, I can't help thinking that there must be a place for romance. I don't know. I may be just an old romantic, but I just don't believe people change.
No, they don't. No.
I mean, one woman's body is very much like another woman's body, with the possible exception of my wife.
I mean, it's like going to the cinema, isn't it? I remember the first time I ever saw Citizen Kane. You know, I thought, you know, I've
great
got to
film.
See this again.
Right.
But the second time, of course, I felt as though I'd seen it all before.
As you had.
As I had.
Yes, I wonder if irrelevancy is the answer.
Well, there isn't any irrelevancy, really, is there? I mean, there's only apathy. No. Rampant apathy.
Ah, but
apathy. Yes. You don't even know what the word means, do you?
Well, no, and I don't care.
Oh, Benjamin, really?
Now, look here. I'm going to batten down the hatches, bring all my hands onto the deck, fire a few points across your bows, and hope they won't go over your head. One. Shooting everybody in dole queues wouldn't create any more jobs. On the other hand, it wouldn't need to. And two, by the same token, it has always struck me as strange that in the name of liberation, women should chain themselves to railings and, to gain more support, burn their braziers.
That is in a nutshell, isn't it, really?
I think so. Or at least, as an argument, I think it'll be a pretty hard nut to crack.
Have you always intended to be an MP?
No, I was going to be a vet. But then I suppose that's every schoolboy's ambition. I'd always enjoyed the company of animals, cows, pigs, that kind of thing. And sheep, of course. But at the same time, I felt I was probably more at home with people. I felt as though I could, you know, understand them a lot better. I just knew somehow that we'd have a lot more in common.
Intuition?
Well, a conditioned reflex of some sort, certainly.
Now, how does your wife fit in?
Well, my wife and I are married. That's the connection there. And yet, you know, we only ever talk about liberation when I'm doing the washing up.
Back to the tea towel.
<That's right. laughs>
Sir Benjamin Fletcher has been in his time Minister of Transport, Minister of Social Services, Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, and Leader of the House of Commons. For his services to the Crown, he was knighted in 1972. This was appropriately but a few weeks before his famous Life's Uncertainty speech to those assembled at the Lord Mayor's banquet at the Guildhall that year.
Her Majesty's Government would like to thank the Right Honourable Lord Mayor for his kind toast. And now to reply on their behalf, Sir Benjamin Fletcher, MP.
My Lord Mayor?
My Lady Mayoress? My Lords, ladies, and gentlemen, I'd like to begin tonight by throwing you straight in at the deep end, if I may, with a little poem from the early part of this century by A. Non. And it goes like this. Across the wires the electric message came. He is no better. He is much the same. Now, you say nonsense. And, of course it is. But, you know, we can sift through that nonsense to find sense. To discover exactly what Antony was thinking about when he composed that little ditty all those years ago. Because I think these words are particularly poignant in view of the current situation that these days we are increasingly finding ourselves in. Now, because Britain is facing the gravest economic crisis since 1380. And you know, many of us still remember the dark days. The eternal torment, worry, exasperation, and all manner of strife. And if we're going to be prepared for the lights going out on our lives once more, we must ask ourselves crucial questions. Where are we? How did we get here? Why did we come? Where do we want to go? How do we want to get to where we want to go? How far do we have to go before we get to where we want to be? How would we know where we were when we got there? Have we got a map? Why did we leave places to get to where we are? What keeps us moving so much? Where were we before that we felt as though we had to leave to get to where we are before we knew we got to where we want to be? Where would we end up if we had the choice? Where would we end up if we didn't have the choice? What would we choose, given the choice? Do we have that choice to choose? Indeed, can we be choosy about the choice chosen? What are the chooses? Choices. Do we want to stop now? Rhetorical. Or do we want to go back to the beginning and start all over again? Perhaps not. But surely you can see my point. Because what I'm talking about is life. Because life is one of those things, isn't it, that most of us find it very difficult to avoid. In the words of David Dimbleby, life is uncertain. My life certainly has a certain uncertainty about it, and I'm certain that yours does too, and with your uncertainty and my uncertainty, there's certainly a certain degree of uncertainty about, of that we can be quite sure. My uncertainty dates back to when I was a child. I was very young in those days, and all I really remember of the time was the 12th birthday party of an old flame called Joyce Maud, who's now a consultant with British Gas. Anyway, I went to this party, aged 14, and got totally drunk. It was one of those affairs where the organizing adult is convinced that cider is of zero alcoholic content. But you see, I knew better, and I got absolutely paralytic. I was rolling about drunk as an empty glass, bombed out of my tree. I was as was I drunk. Really very, very drunk indeed. Completely pissed. So halfway through the party, I thought I should go for a walk to sober up. And I stumbled out of the back door of the house into the black of the night. It was pitch dark. Black everywhere. There was just darkness as far as the eye could see. But I was in no fit state to care about any such thing. So I just strode out into the grounds and very soon, of course, I was lost. I knew I was lost because I didn't know where the hell I was going. In trying to retrace my steps after 10 minutes, I seemed to be heading deeper and deeper into woods and rough country. I felt as though I was going round in circles.
I started to hit out in all directions, crying for help. In the panic, my whole life seemed to swim before me. One great, dark, grotesque, pestilential swirl seemed to envelop my mind and my senses and my vision. I had never been more frightened since the day my mother first showed me the plumbing beneath the kitchen sink. And just when I thought I was at the end of my tether, a voice penetrated the gloom. "Benjamin," it said, "quod facias." It was Joyce, carrying a Latin grammar. "Veni, vidi," I observed wryly. "Sed non sum ubi expectare esse." She looked me hard in the eye. "Castuis positis," she enjoined it. "Caesare rapuit Virgiles." "Why did he tell us that story? Do I hear you quiet?" "No. Well, it's all to do with guidance, isn't it, really? About guiding people. About telling each other where to go. Because we must have purpose. We must not be purposeless. We must not exhibit purposelessness. We must be purposelessnessless. We must all act like guides. Like girl guides. They guide people, don't they? And, of course, they're girls. And girl guides, like Boy Scouts, they have their motto, don't they? Because we must be prepared for this fight. It is easier for a witch man to pass through the eye of a needle than it is for a camel to... than it is for a camel to. Let's buckle down, should we? Because we don't want to end up, do we? Because we don't want to end up, do we? Like the blind man in the dark womb, looking for the black cat that isn't there. Thank you, thank you, thank you very much.
Sir Benjamin Fletcher, writer, statesman, soldier and academic, cabinet minister, philosopher, Nobel Prize winner, Christian, scholar, broadcaster, and television personality. Next week, we look at Hugh Greenwood, the new chairman of BSC, the British Steel Corporation. British Sugar Corporation. British Shipbuilders Corporation Company? Conglomerate. Cult. So until then, from me, David Rudman, it's goodbye. Goodbye.
Benjamin Fletcher's autobiography, blue-rinsed but never whitewashed, is published by Henley & Soames at £5.95.